This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
So I'll introduce you first to our panellists. On the far end, we have Sharon Lewin. Sharon is an infectious diseases physician and basic scientist. She's the inaugural director of the Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity at the University of Melbourne, consultant physician, Alfred Hospital, Melbourne, and an Australian National Health and Medical Research Council practitioner fellow. Her lab focuses on strategies to cure HIV infection and the pathogenesis of HIV hepatitis B co-infection. She was the local co-chair of the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne in 2014, and it was the largest health conference ever held in Australia. She's on the leadership team of the International AIDS Society's Strategy Towards HIV Cure, and she's a member of the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Bloodborne Viruses and Sexually Transmitted Infections. So welcome, Sharon. Next, we have Kate White. Kate is an internationally recognised researcher on gender and higher education. She's adjunct associate professor at Federation University Australia and co-director of the nine-country research consortium, the Women in Higher Education Management Network. Her research focuses on gender and higher education, women's academic careers and women in science, and her book Keeping Women in Science, which I read last week, it's fantastic, we'll talk about that tonight, was released by MUP in January 2015. Dr. Catherine Mack, Katie Mack, is a theoretical cosmologist. Her work focuses on finding new ways to learn about the early universe and fundamental physics using astronomical observations, probing the building blocks of nature by examining the cosmos on the largest scales. Throughout her career as a researcher at Caltech, Princeton, Cambridge, and now the University of Melbourne, she has studied dark matter, black holes, cosmic strings, and the formation of the first galaxies in the universe. Kate is also an active online science communicator and is passionate about science outreach. As a science writer, she has been published by Slate, Cosmos, Sky and Telescope, Time.com, The Economist, Tech Blog, Babbage, and other popular publications. So welcome to all of our panellists this evening. Now, I'm a non-scientist on this panel. I'm a writer, but I do have some experience in the science field. I used to work as a solicitor for an organisation called the Victorian Cancer Agency. So my experience is really in negotiating funding agreements with medical scientists at all levels of their careers. Hopefully I can give a little tiny bit of input into the kind of discussions that go on within that kind of a funding body about the issues that we'll be talking about today. I wanted to begin by asking the panellists how they came to science. There's been a lot of reports, which I'll talk about a bit later, concerning girls' involvement in science, particularly in Australia. So I'm interested in finding out, perhaps we'll do Kate first. Sharon first. How you first came to science? Was it something you were always attracted to as a young girl? And as you moved through high school, how did that kind of play out for you in terms of role models and people that could assist you in your interest?
Yeah, so I was always really interested in science. Actually, you know, serious physical sciences, a bit more like Katie's history, physics and pure maths and applied maths at high school, and wanted to be an engineer or an astronaut. And my parents said, no, we don't want you to do something like that. You'd be much better off just starting in medicine. I went to a co-ed school, and I was actually the only girl I remember in the pure maths and applied maths classes. And even though it was the 70s, I don't think I even really noticed it. It was a school that really encouraged equality. If I think about my teachers, they were largely male, but very encouraging that women should be in science, girls should be in science. There was no question. But then I ended up going to medicine, which, of course, is doing medicine, and spending my first few years thinking about switching to engineering, but I stayed in medicine. And And of course, that environment is very. Even when I was there, I did medicine at Monash in the early 80s. It was 50% female. Biological sciences attract a lot more women. But I grew to really love clinical medicine and, you know, the amazing spectrum of work you can do as a doctor. But I always really wanted to get back to answering a scientific question that was going to have a very big impact on how we practice medicine. So I didn't actually come back to science really, because I did medicine and all my clinical training, and that'll takes about 13 years, and then I went and did a PhD. So I came to doing my science late in my career, which is quite common for physician scientists. A lot of people say you're past your most creative and productive times as a scientist when you're past your 20s. But I did my PhD in my early 30s, actually, with a young family, and then did a postdoc overseas. So I came to it late, and I'd have to say I worked in an environment that was actually quite supportive for women. I know that a lot of physician scientists and many people that work in biology haven't experienced that, but my personal experience was good. And then I have had some great role models. My PhD supervisor was a physician scientist, Suzanne Crowe, who I still collaborate with. And then I had an amazing role model who I got to know very well in organising the AIDS conference. My co-chair was Françoise Barres-Inoussi, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV in 2008. She discovered HIV in the early 80s as a young scientist in France, and faced enormous discrimination as a woman. So I've really had some fantastic role models, which I think has helped along the way.
Okay. And Katie, was that your experience? Were you always drawn to science?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've wanted to be a cosmologist since I was about 10 years old. I used to read about black holes and space-time and the Big Bang, and I heard about this person, Stephen Hawking, who was studying these things, and I found out that he was a cosmologist. So I said, I want to be a cosmologist. I want to study the big questions, you know, the universe and everything it's made of, and I wanted to, you know, figure out the basic laws of nature, basically. So I was on that path pretty early, and I ended up getting involved in research quite early as well. I had some good opportunities to be a sort of intern in a few different areas of science. So I worked at a geophysics lab for a little while in high school, and I ended up also working in particle physics as a high schooler in Japan, and I got to go to a neutrino detector in Japan when I was, I think, probably 17. So I did get involved very early, and I got to be part of that sort of research environment very early. But I think that in terms of having, you know, mentors and role models, most of them were men. I worked with physics professors, and there are very few female physics professors even now, and there were fewer in the 80s and 90s when I was sort of learning about it. But I don't think I noticed that so much. I think I was really focused on just doing the thing. There were a few times when it definitely came up. When I was in Japan, one of the times I was in Japan, I was working at an accelerator facility, and I was working in a Japanese group representing an American university. And while I was there, I was the only undergraduate, the only American, and the only woman in the group. And in that environment, in that culture, that's, you know, below the dirt in terms of the hierarchy. And I definitely noticed that, and I noticed that all of my colleagues there were men. And I think that I had a bit of a stubbornness, and I kind of liked the idea of feeling special, like, oh, I'm this different person. I've achieved this thing that, you know, very few other women have done, and so I thought that was I found that kind of fun. I've been very lucky in terms of not in experiencing a lot of outright discrimination or anything like that throughout my scientific career, despite being in fields that are very heavily male dominated.
Mm. thank you. And Kate, I guess I'd like to ask you the same question. You specialise in gender and higher education. Mm-hmm. Was it always evident to you that education would be a way out for women? When did that become crystallising for you?
Quite early on, I think. I was always encouraged by my parents to think that I'd go to university. I'm not a scientist. I'm a gender researcher. So my background is, my PhD was actually in political science. And I've actually written about my career a book that I edited with Barbara Bagalhol in the UK in 2011 called Generation and Gender in Academia. Has a chapter about my academic career, if anyone is interested. But I guess I've always been interested in gender and issues around gender. I co-authored a book in 1984 on women in Australian politics. But the last 20 years, my focus has really been on gender in higher education. And it was in that context that the Florey Institute invited me to come and work with them on a project on career paths for women in science, which is the subject of the book Keeping Women in Science.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I guess moving on into now, in terms of what you're doing in your fields at the moment, what is the biggest issue that you see for women? Is it flexibility in the workplace? Is it those kind of early career paths from PhD onwards? We were talking earlier about that work-life balance in terms of when do you start a family if you're a scientist in a profession that's geared towards people who are unattached and who are able to move wherever the work is. For each of you, and also for yourself, Kate, what do you see as the single most important issue for female scientists in terms of career progression?
I might start. So for the non-scientists in the room, most scientists survive on competitive funding, and so you've got to be incredibly productive and constantly coming up with a new great idea, selling your idea, selling yourself, and competing against your peers. And at the moment, the funding, at least in biological sciences in Australia, is about 15% of applications. So there's very little. Within biological sciences, very little security in that. But if you love it, and you want to continue that, and you want to be able to design an interesting question and answer it, and continue in, you know, doing your passion and not being restricted in what you work on, that's what you face every 3 years, sometimes a bit longer. And I think the really, really hard... So that's a tough career for anyone, male or female, but the really tough thing for women is that transition, which is tough for all scientists, from being trained under someone as a PhD and a postdoc, and then to have enough creativity and ideas and success to justify getting your own funding. And that usually comes in your sort of early 30s or mid-30s when you might be having a family. So we were talking before about the collision of work and family, and it really happens at a time that's critical for you getting independence and getting money. So it's that, I think that's a huge barrier. So a lot of really bright women who do their PhDs and postdocs look at this and think, not possible. You know, I want to be home with my baby, really hard. I think it is possible, but I think that's a big, big barrier. And then I do think women do naturally undersell themselves a bit. And science, of course, science is a meritocracy. You're judged on how good you are, ranked on a whole lot of criteria on, you know, the quality of the work you publish and capacity to get money. But you've also got to be able to sell the story a bit and have confidence in the story or your findings. And I do think men sometimes do that better than women as well. And that is a really big part of your success too. So I think both those things are issues.
Okay. And would you agree with those, Katie?
Well, I think that the sort of career structure is definitely something that forces more choices for women than it does for men. Part of that is sort of biological, and part of it is cultural. So a lot of times, in my field anyway, it's expected that you do your PhD and then you go on and you do postdoctoral fellowships in different places. And by the time you're living in a single place for a long period of time, you're in your mid or late 30s. And so, and during those postdoc years, that's when you're expected to be the most productive and the most work-focused. And it comes at a time when people are normally trying to start families or have relationships. You know, a lot of my friends from home are married, have children, all of that. And that's not something that's something that's very difficult for me at this stage in my career, because I'm moving all the time. Every few years I'm going somewhere else in order to follow my career. And that's, you know, so that sort of choice is less often forced for men, because just culturally it's much more common for women to make career sacrifices in order to follow their male partners, if that's the situation they're in. And so a lot of my male colleagues, their wife just follows them wherever they're going. And that's a lot harder for women to get that to happen. And it's also an issue that in sciences, where the field is much more male dominated, it's more common for the women in the field to be dating men in the field, and so they're much more likely to face this issue than the men are, because they tend to be dating people who are not in the same area, and so they might have more flexible careers. So I definitely think that that's something that comes up a lot and is a problem. But I also think that, especially in the physical sciences, just the kinds of, I don't know, unconscious bias or even consciously stated bias is something that can be really frustrating for women and can hurt their careers. So there have been studies about, you know, reference letters having different focus for men and women. And so if you're applying for a job and you're a woman, your letter is much more likely to say that you're, you know, agreeable or conscientious. And if you're a man, you're much more likely to be called brilliant or, you know, I mean, those kinds of biases do exist. And, you know, just navigating all of that is... It can be very frustrating. I mean, I've certainly encountered a lot of women in my field who just who have to deal with being thought to be less good because they're women, or even dealing with harassment from senior colleagues and not having a way to deal with that well while still maintaining their position. And that's something that comes up a lot. So I think a lot of it is in fields as male-dominated as mine. There are a lot of these cultural things where, you know, living in a society that has a lot of sexism, academia also has a lot of sexism. We're not separate from that. And people think that we are. We think that, oh, we're, you know, it's all a meritocracy and everything is perfect and, you know, we're not biased. And I think that impression, that feeling that people have that, oh, we're scientists, we can't possibly be biased in this way, makes it worse, because then, you know, people think, oh, I must be judging this totally objectively, and if you can't make it, it's because you're not good enough, not because, you know, people have been systematically passing you over for things and undermining you.
Yeah. And Kate, you talk about many of these issues in your book, particularly mm-hmm. that issue of mid-career progression and these kinds of conscious and unconscious biases. Mm-hmm. Were there any findings that really surprised you?
I'd just like to pick up on Katie's point about the entrenched male leadership. It was very clear in the case study I did of the Florey Institute. Looking at their Parkville campus in 2011, at undergrad or PhD level, 65% of the students were female. But when you looked at senior management, the percentage of women was zero. There were no women in senior management. So what's going on? What's the process that's going on there between this overrepresentation of women as PhD students and by the time they go through their postdocs into senior research officer, into research fellows, and at the end of that, as you go up the ladder, the women aren't there. They've disappeared. So, yes, there is conscious and unconscious bias going on, and it's not just around women having children or not having children. That conscious and unconscious bias also affects women who don't have children, and some women in science make a conscious decision about not having children. It still happens. I mean, I had some senior males say to me, look, Kate, a woman's got a choice in science. She can either be a brilliant scientist or a mother, but she can't be both. So that I found that quite surprising. These were the baby boomers who are now in leadership positions. Not all, but some had that view. The most surprising finding and heartening finding of my research is that the younger generation are not buying this. Both the men and the women, the Gen X and Gen Y, want a different way of doing science. They want more work-life balance. They don't want to work the 14-hour days, 6 days a week. The men are working out, younger men are working out ways to work 4 days a week, work a full-time load 4 days a week so they can be home with children 1 day a week. There's a lot more flexibility required because you've got dual careers for particularly the Gen Ys, there are dual careers. And so it's not just one career that they're juggling, which was the baby boomer situation. You had a wife who did the housework, looked after the children. There are two careers to consider. So there is a huge change going on. And some of the younger men were saying, don't care if I'm not in the 5% of top 5% of scientists, I want to achieve some sort of work-life balance. And the women are saying, those that are coming back off maternity leave, I want my decision to come back initially part-time respected by my colleagues. I don't want to be sidelined and told that I'm a lightweight because I'm choosing at this point in my career to work part-time and that I'm less committed. So the Gen X, but particularly the Gen Y, are really clear about how they want to do science. And the younger men are also clear that there is discrimination against women in science, and as I say, they don't buy it. They don't want to see science leadership continue in this way. So I'm very optimistic that when, as they move into leadership roles, we really will see a change. Having said that, we are still, science in Australia, as in most countries, is working with a really inflexible funding model, and that doesn't encourage flexibility in careers at any point in science careers.
Mm-hmm. When I was working with funding agreements, one of the key issues was people in that kind of early career seed fellowship space going on maternity leave, and how do we renegotiate these milestones? Can this person do this project part-time? And there was a lot of conversation at that time, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, about what kind of models were around in terms of contracts that could be malleable and flexible in that way. Do you see this at your end? Do you see a change there in terms of what funding bodies, the kind of flexibility they're willing to allow?
I think there is. I think there's a real recognition in many institutes, hospitals, universities about this problem, and at the major funder, which is the National Health and Medical Research Council, they have got strategies to try and account productivity based on opportunity. That hasn't really worked that well, but they've got a bit better at it. Some organisations really provide strategies to help women coming back with childcare based on science. A lot don't. I mean, we don't have that at the Doherty, for example, but others are planning or have that. So childcare on-site or additional funding to give researchers give an additional research assistant. So I think there are strategies to do it, but the reality is science is really competitive and you have to get your answer first. Mm-hmm. You know, not first in Australia, first internationally. And so if it's going to be slowed down, you're going to miss out on that opportunity. So teamwork can help. You know, doing, and a lot of research now is large collaborative teams. And I think a lot of big ants, it's not the scientists sitting alone in their labs, you know, beavering away. It's part of big collaborative teams. And I think if the leadership of those teams recognise this, you can get the best out of people, even though some of them are working part-time. It's a team effort.
Yeah. And we were talking in the green room about the difference between the number of women who go into biological sciences and the number of women that go into hard sciences. Are there other differences in terms of, you know, because women need a more flexible space, are they more inclined to go into the research side of things as opposed to being in, you know, a practical lab space? Or are there other kind of differences in terms of the career paths that are made?
I think in my field, I don't notice it. Well, there are big differences in sort of subfields in astronomy and physics. There are far fewer women in theoretical physics than in lab-based physical science areas. But I think that there's also been, from what I understand, a bit more women in adjunct positions, in sort of non-tenure track kind of positions than in tenure track, partially possibly because of this timeline issue. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And what was your experience, Kate, in terms of the institute where you did your research, in terms of the type of academic positions that were held, not necessarily in terms of the hierarchy, but in terms of the nature of position?
I'd like to pick up on the discussion around what works for women, particularly women who go on maternity leave. Mm-hmm. In this case study, there were some very good models that had been developed in the institute. One in particular where a young woman had, as soon as she was pregnant, had told her supervisor that, look, hey, I'm pregnant, and he said, fine, we're going to start working on this now. So they developed a strategy during her pregnancy. They brought in a research assistant to carry on her research while, even before she went on maternity leave, there was sort of very good communication between the woman on maternity leave, the supervisor, research assistant. And one of the really interesting things was the supervisor encouraged this woman to attend two international conferences before she went on maternity leave, because that was they were opportunities that she needed, even though she would be out of the workforce for a while. And then she transitioned back part-time. And it was such a good model. And because what it relied on was good communication between the supervisor and the young woman going on maternity leave. And I think that a lot of institutes are working towards these sorts of models of keeping women engaged in research, of saying it's not an either-or. You're either a first-rate scientist or you're a parent, but you can't be both. So, you know, there's some really good science leadership at the moment where they're trying to keep women engaged during that sort of rush hour period where it's difficult for them.
Mm-hmm. And there are a number of recommendations in your book as well, most of them, I think, that the organisation actually took on in terms of facilitating career progress for women.
Yeah.
What were those?
Well, there were recommendations around getting greater representation of women on committees within the institute, and they've been taken up, and also to... And targets were set as well, not just recommendations, but targets. And there were also targets set around increasing the number of women as senior research fellows, and they're being worked towards at the moment. So it was really nice to work on a project with... I was working with the Equality in Science group at Florey, and I said from the beginning, really, you know, this is a collaborative project because you have to own it, you know. I'm not there to... I'm not there to ensure that the recommendations are implemented. So it's... And it's sort of... It's still ongoing, so it's been a really nice collaboration.
Yeah. And Katie, the issue that you raised in terms of maintaining relationships and maintaining that kind of work-life balance when you have to constantly travel for work, what do you see as some things that might be done in terms of, you know, apart from men actually travelling where their partners work, are there any practical things you can think of that might alleviate that situation?
I mean, it's a very hard problem with the current structure of the career of academic careers in physical sciences, because moving to a different institution for a few years is actually really good for developing your career as a scientist, developing new leadership skills, new collaborations, and so on. The fact that it's been changing over time so that you have to do that more is a problem. So a few decades ago, it was expected that you would go from a PhD position, you know, go from getting your PhD to becoming junior faculty. Then it became you do a postdoc and then you go on to faculty. And now two postdocs is pretty normal in my field. Three is becoming normal. And a postdoc is a couple of years, two or three years long, roughly, usually. And that sort of hopping around the world is just really hard. I mean, in terms of maintaining any kind of grounding is very difficult. I think that if there were longer fellowships, or even just if there were fewer postdoc positions so that it was the sort of cutoff point was earlier in the career structure, personally, I feel like that would help, because at the moment there's far fewer faculty jobs than postdoc jobs, to such an extent that it's very common for people to do two or three postdoc jobs and then not get a faculty job. Mm-hmm. And so people end up making these huge sacrifices and then not necessarily continuing in the field. And it would be, I think, better for everybody in the field if there were fewer postdoc positions, they were longer, and so you go from getting your PhD to going on to maybe one, maybe two postdocs, and then you're somewhere permanent, and I think that would definitely help a lot. I mean, obviously the best thing would be if, you know, culture changed entirely and these things were, you know, there was no expectation that the man's career was more important and just everybody was equal. But in the meantime...
Yeah, there's a quote in this book by Sharon Bell. I don't know how many of you have read the book by Professor Sharon Bell from a 2009 report that she did, where she said, "When we document attrition, we are mapping accumulated disappointment, frustration, and unrealized expectations impacting significantly on individuals." And that report in particular, you know, just looked at this idea of losing women to science and, you know, why do we lose them? And it is very much to do with that issue of, you know, how do you balance life when you have this career that is expected to be all-consuming and you're expected to put your everything into. I've been reading kind of a lot of the reports that have coming out, as you probably all have, about girls in science in Australia. And there was, a 2013 report that came out that said that 15-year-old girls actually way outperform the boys in all countries except Canada, the UK and the US in science. But yet 2 years later we had a report saying that only one in four girls are choosing the subjects to enable them to pursue a science. And I was interested when Sharon and Katie, you were talking about your experiences of growing up and going into the sciences. You both kind of seem to have been supported into that path. Katie, you had a lot of opportunities, you know, when you were kind of a teenager, and you know, although you said your parents kind of cautioned you against going into the hard sciences, you know, you were supported in that. And,
Sharon, you also expressed that at that academic level that there's perhaps a reluctance of women to put themselves forward. And these reports were kind of saying that the difference in engaging girls in science is about convincing them that they actually have the ability. It's not about them actually having the ability. It's about kind of building that confidence. How much of a loss to science in terms of girls going into the field and women staying in the field can be attributed, do you think, to just being a woman and that kind of self-confidence that you have when you come into the world as a male child that you don't have as a woman?
Well, I think that in physics especially, and in other sciences like physics, where there's a lot of men and there's been that history, women are just repeatedly told that it's not for girls, and they absorb that message very young and constantly over time. There was a study out of University of Melbourne recently, actually, looking at the number of girls going into physics bachelor's and master's programs, and showed that the numbers are actually going down a little bit. And one of the reasons that the young women would give for not staying in physics was that they felt like physics was too hard for girls, and they'd absorbed this message from outside saying that it was this, you know, that their gender was going to hold them back. And I find that really, really frustrating and really tragic. I think that it's I think that, you know, the confidence thing does come into it, but I think it's also just constantly having people say, you know, that you're not going to be good enough, you're never going to make it, you're not brilliant enough. You know, it comes back to this idea that there are some fields where people talk about them as though, oh, if you work hard, you'll make it, and other fields like physics where people talk about it as you have to be a genius. Mm-hmm. And girls are not told they're geniuses, they're not told that they're brilliant, and they're not given the idea that they can be brilliant, that they can work hard and achieve something. They're told, well, you're not naturally good at math, you're not naturally good at physics, you're never going to do it. And that, I find that just so deeply frustrating, especially, you know, in light of so many studies that show that there really is no difference. But, you know, people see, you know, people absorb that. I mean, I've had undergrads come to me and ask about careers in physics, and you know, say that they'd already been told by their classmates that they weren't good enough, and that they were never going to make it because they were a girl, and girls are not good enough. And I've had girls come to me and say, you know, I want to go into physics, but I'm worried, you know, will my work be judged equally to my male classmates? And that's a really frustrating question to have to answer, because from what I understand, you know, probably not. And girls, you know, people don't want to go into a situation like that where they know that they're going to be disadvantaged and looked down upon. And so I think, you know, that's something that is a major pressure and really, really frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And Sharon,
I don't think you see that so much in medicine or in biological sciences, because you definitely have a lot of women enter, do very, very well. I think what happens is the decisions, it's a bit about culture, so there's certain specialties that are just less women-friendly, and probably because there was a lot in the paper recently about surgery and neurosurgeons and culture, you know, these embed, and I think maybe Kate was describing that a little bit with male leadership. So that's a bit of a turn-off, I think. People think, you know, why, you know, it's not an attractive environment to work. I'm not saying that exists everywhere, but there are pockets of that in some specialties of medicine and some areas of science, and then it becomes the work-life balance. You know, how much do I really want to work, and how much am I going to give up? And then that tends to less. I think that what you're describing about I'm not good enough or I can't do it, I don't think I've seen that a lot in young, you know, amazing, young, bright, talented physicians, doctors, scientists. It becomes just that decision about, you know, where I belong. Do I belong in this sort of environment? And then how much am I willing to give up? And in the end, you know, this thing about model, you know, how science works, you know, people do it because they're really passionate about it. And so it doesn't become I really love science, but I only want to work 9 to 5. Not many people say that. They say, I really love it because, and I just want to get the answer. And, you know, it's, you know, you kind of need that, otherwise you wouldn't stay in it. So 9 to 5.
And, Kate, there are those four key areas that come out of your report, and one of them you said was this real passion.
Passion, yeah. I'd like to pick up on Sharon's point there. I mean, as a non-scientist, when what I asked these scientists was, you know, what gives you job satisfaction? And it was such a privilege to hear them share their utter passion for science. And so I'd say to any of you in the audience who are science teachers, that's what you really need to, I think, convey, particularly to young men and women who are in, you know, high school at the moment. These are not ordinary jobs. These are very special jobs, and the scientists see it that way, you know, and they have this incredible passion. There's a chapter in my book that just talks about their passion for science. And, you know, it was, as I say, a privilege to hear these stories. But it also was reassuring as a non-scientist to think these people are the brightest and the best, and Australia is really lucky to have these young, committed science researchers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There are two other areas that I want to just cover. We are going to have a brief 10-minute question time at the end. But I just wanted to ask you, I guess, about the issue of scientific research into women's health areas, and whether you think that feminism has a role to play. You know, things like the development of the pill and surgical terminations have done such incredible things in terms of women's freedoms. And I remember a friend saying to me once that if men gave birth, childbirth would be completely pain-free, you know. There wouldn't even be an epidural, they've come up with something else, you know. How much does gender play, do you think, in terms of what is researched and which areas funding goes into?
It's actually a big issue in my own field of HIV because when a country like Australia... you know, 80% of people living with HIV are male because it's transmitted amongst men who have sex with men. But globally, 60% of people living with HIV are women, because in low-income countries in Africa, it's transmission through heterosexual sex, and in Eastern Europe and US through injecting drug use. And there's a big issue about women participation in clinical trials in HIV. And in fact, I think you, in answering questions that are relevant for women around contraception and menopause and, you know, sexual function, a whole lot of things that often aren't addressed. And it's interesting to see in the US, the National Institutes of Health, which are their major funders, you know, really require that you have equal enrolment of men and women in clinical trials. And so there's quite a big push to this. In Australia, it's very we can't do that here. We don't have those patients. But in countries where women are left out of clinical trials and actually carry the burden of disease, why aren't they, don't they have equal representation? And there's a whole lot of reasons why, because they're too busy to be involved in clinical trials, they've got to go and pick up their kids, they're juggling work and families. And so there's quite a lot of interest in this and ways to address it. And often those the change really comes when it's driven from the top. We're not going to fund you unless you have 50% enrolment of women and men. And some funding bodies are doing that. Really very common issue in my field, but I think in clinical trials in general.
Yeah. In your field, Katie, do you see, I guess it's slightly different, but I mean, do you see kind of gender issues playing a part in what's researched, or, you know, is there a way to put a feminist perspective on the work that you do? What does it mean to be a feminist cosmologist? Yeah. Is the universe a she?
I mean, in my field, it's like nobody, just people don't talk about gender at all. And I mean, I think that's problematic at some level, right? Because there's, you know, this representation issue. I mean, it's just I think in my area, it would be. It would be better if there was more of an understanding that feminism is really important for, you know, advancing the field just by bringing in more talent and making things more fair. And it's kind of, it's very rarely discussed, mm-hmm. which I think is a shame.
Mm-hmm. And Kay, what role does feminism have to play in your research?
Well, look, there's change happening in Europe at the moment, which is really exciting. The European Research Area's new funding program, Horizon 2020, every scientist that submits an application for that funding, and we're talking about big buckets of funding, has to consider the gender dimension in their research proposal. Mm. So there's been various groups working towards this in Europe for some time, and it's actually got up for Horizon 2020. So that's very good. So when a proposal's being evaluated, they're wanting to see some consideration of the gender dimension in that research project.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone. It's been fascinating to listen to your experiences. There's six of us here from the McClintock Collective in the 1980s, and we kind of developed because of that notion that we were reforming education, that science itself was gendered. So I'm kind of interested in what you... And the inclusive curriculum. And I guess one of the issues, I'd say, between 15 and 17, young women get turned off science as much as the kind of cultural, societal factors you're talking about. You know, the monkey shot, out of a tree at this angle, and all this kind of... the disconnection that's evident in some of the physical sciences and biological science. So I'm interested what you think of science itself and what its responsibility is in relation to all of this that we worked so hard to change, I guess, in the 1990s.
Look, quickly, one of the things I've argued in my book is that the model of the successful scientist, I think, has traditionally been what I've coined the monastic male. So, to be successful in science, you do the science and that's all you do. You don't have a life apart from doing science. And then there was that model changed slightly, for the baby boomer generation. Yes, okay, they did have partners and families, but the partners and families did all the other things so that they could do the science. But I think that what we need to do is demolish that myth, and I think the Gen Ys are going to do that. The monastic male as the model of the successful scientist... we just need to do away with it because it doesn't serve any purpose anymore.
Hi. Thanks very much for your talks. I just wanted to put the spotlight a bit more about what Sharon was saying on how tough science is, and it doesn't matter what gender you are. I was a former research scientist. The stress is incredible. Publish or perish. And... So it really doesn't matter what your gender is. I certainly saw a lot of my male colleagues suffer with that dictum. Is there perhaps a place for a bit of psychology of what research really is all about that would be helpful to early stage career scientists? Basically an acknowledgement is this is a terribly, terribly competitive survival of the fittest environment. It really doesn't matter what gender you are. Maybe if you're a female, maybe you need a bit more help with that. Maybe women are more susceptible to anxiety and stress than men generally. I don't know. You might comment on that. But in a way, I think the gender issue is not all that useful. I think this is a terribly, terribly tough career, no matter what gender you are, and an acknowledgement of the what sort of a psychology and mindset you need would be helpful for anyone.
Yeah, I agree. It's competitive. It's not, and it's competitive and tough, and there's constant pressures, and I think managing the anxiety and the fear that you actually got no job security for many scientists as well. It's incredible that that's people put up with that. But it's, you know, it's actually, it's not cutthroat. So there's actually quite a lot of collegiality about around scientists. So that's very, you know, I hear about lawyers. I'm sure there's a few lawyers in the room. And, or lawyers, Maxine. But, you know, that's competitive and it sounds a bit cutthroat too. You know, you actually have a lot of collegiality amongst scientists, interestingly. Even though we are competing against each other, there is incredible collegiality within your own discipline and between disciplines. So that's helpful. And I do think people survive it when they, because of that, of the passion, and they love what they do and they can see an end point. I also think, though, that we haven't discussed this at all, that there are alternative careers in academia in science. We've just talked about that today, really, because of our backgrounds. But, you know, there's industry, science and industry, which has got a very different career structure and can be, has totally different, it's not, it's hard to do discovery research in that environment, but it's possible. You know, there's education, there's science communications, journalism, you know, so I think there are other, and of course in medicine, the beauty of doing research and medicine is that you can use it to inform and change your practice, and you may spend a varying amount of time in clinical practice and research. So I think when we're talking about that hardcore, super competitive, publish or perish, it's in academia. And I think, we probably do need better support structures, but you turn everyone off, I think, if you that's how you welcome new scientists into the game. I think you want to inspire people about the possibilities and the impact that they could have with great ideas, but match it, of course, with the reality of being successful in it. But at least in biological sciences, there are alternative, very satisfying careers that have different limitations but different rewards as well.
Hi. I just have sort of a general question about your opinions on large corporations such as Facebook and Google offering women to freeze their eggs, and what sort of impact you think that has on people's career longevity or changing of their opinions on family versus science careers, and if you think it would extend to your professions.
So I worry that by the time you realize you're going to have to freeze your eggs, it's probably too late to freeze your eggs. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, when you get started in science, I think a lot of people don't realize when they get started how difficult it is to balance these things out and what kinds of challenges they'll face with that. So there's a lot of planning ahead to be able to freeze your eggs. As a possibility, but I mean, why not just offer maternity leave and I think this is a big problem in the U.S. There was a press release the other day. MIT announced that they were now going to offer 5 whole days of paid maternity leave to their staff, to their scientists. You know. And that was worthy of a press release, because in the U.S. there's no mandated paid maternity leave in universities or any institution. So the fact that was newsworthy is telling. You know, I think that there are some really good models here in my field. In astronomy, we have this big center of excellence, called Castro, where now there's a rule that every job offered by Castro has to be offered as part-time as an option. So, to make that more open to people who are trying to balance families and career, those kinds of things can be really great. I think those are better options than egg freezing, but you know.
Kate, do you think many of your interviewees would take up that opportunity if it was offered to them?
Of
freezing, egg freezing?
I don't think so. I didn't ask them that.
Hi there. I just wanted to say thanks also for all of your, you know, wisdom and contributions. And as a non-scientist and a lawyer who's probably not as cutthroat as she needs to be, I just kind of wanted to go back to sort of, I think it's come up sort of, but, you know, we talked about the idea of girls lacking confidence and where that comes from. And I guess the main thing that I wanted to kind of hear opinions on and I don't know, explore is that I mean, I guess the role that science has to play in either disproving or potentially, I guess, further entrenching what we understand to be sort of gender differences, you know, things that we consider to be biological differences between men and women that will either, I guess, I don't know, inhibit or... just that argument that, you know, there are certain female qualities that lend themselves to certain, you know, fields or sort of dispositions, you know, that idea of the ruthless, cutthroat, super confident man as being potentially biological rather than a social construct. And I guess just the tensions and I don't know, the reception to that sort of research that does sort of come up and gets picked up on in the media in a way that, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be for other types of gender-based research. So,
I think that most research suggests very strongly that gender is socially constructed.
As a researcher, I find it amazing that people think that you can do this experiment on, you know, how people express their, you know, how people express their personalities and attribute it entirely to genetics when you've been growing up in this culture and you've got, like, you can't distinguish those effects at all based on the things that are measured. I mean, as soon as the child is taken home from the hospital, they're wrapped in pink or blue. From what I've read from the literature I've seen, there's no basis for truly hardwired biological differences in personality between men and women or aptitude or anything like that. And I think it's going to take a lot of time to get that message across, especially because studies saying, you know, oh, you know, men are different from women, here's the proof in the brain scans, those get so much press because people like to hear that kind of thing. They like to hear, oh, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and it's just going to take a lot of reinforcing, you know, no, that really isn't true. And I don't know how long that'll take, but hopefully the message gets across.
Over there. We'll have two more questions and then we'll have to call time, I'm afraid. So,
I just wanted to address the issue of grant writing. I think there's a great deal of patronage and people like them on their grants with them. And I think that militates against women when it's generally men at the top. I also think having NH and MRC grants going in right at the beginning of the year when you're trying to deal with kids on holiday is a pain in the butt. I mean, I'm somebody who's been a university researcher for 25 years, nearly 30 years, on soft money, and you rewrite and rewrite the grants, and the amount of time that's spent on that is such a waste. There must be a more efficient way of doing that. And that was fine when I was had a partner, but now I'm a single parent, and that precariousness is now not a luxury I can afford.
Yeah, I think it's exactly the issues we were talking about the tough issues around security and ongoing funding. But the suggestion around the timing of grants is a really good one, because they're at a shocking time if you've got kids. So I think there are systematic changes that can all go towards helping in that way. Just in response to the other question, I was just thinking about when we think about scientists and brilliance and, sitting in your office and coming up with this amazing idea. But actually labs labs are sort of run like little businesses, and there's a lot of issues around management and leadership to get the best productivity from your team and teamwork. And so I think there are other skills that scientists need beyond just being brilliant at the content and the technical stuff. And the getting women at the higher levels of leadership needs these other skills, and that can be introduced in a more systematic way, because it's a little random in most places. And the same probably with communication and selling your story and packaging it so a large group can understand the work that you're doing. And so I think there are things like that could really assist upskill people that don't have those skills naturally, and often women find that a bit harder, the management and leadership, you know, maybe naturally, but there are probably ways that we could better train the workforce of scientific leaders.
Okay. Last question, I'm afraid.
Yeah. One thing that hasn't changed over time is young women's interest in the consequences of science. And as you've been speaking, I've been thinking about the ethical issues that surround which questions are researched, Ebola, even eggs, we're talking about eggs, surrogacy, and also how the questions are framed within a, you know, Anglo-Celtic, white male culture dominated. And that's where the money goes and that's where the research goes. But young women consistently have said they're interested in the consequences and they want a science that is not just the finding out the answers but how it's going to impact on humankind. So I wondered if you've seen any trends of those sort of projects being more successful for women or your example of having to have a gender aspect in a research question, I suppose it's a part of that.
Yeah, look, I think you're going to have, you need a change at the top. You need a change in how research is funded. And so the European research area has done that. I mean, they've actually built a gender dimension into their funding framework. And that's when you will get real change. I don't see that the NHMRC has introduced that into their funding framework at the moment. But that's the sort of seismic shift that will be needed so that the gender dimension is part of and is evaluated in every project that's put up for funding.
Okay, that's a great place to end. Thank you so much to all of our panellists, Sharon, Kate and Katie. Please give them a round of applause.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.